in Lebanon is something that sticks very strongly in the Saudi throat. And so they're finding any means possible to punish Lebanon because it remains faithful to Hezbollah and obviously respectful of its influence and its role in politics, which is obviously, it sits in parliament and has a strong popular base across the population. So this is a major reason, not the only one.
Well, Hafsa, let me just play devil's advocate here, because there would be Lebanese that say then that is the problem. Then if Hezbollah wasn't that influential, that they could live in peace.
Well, Hezbollah is influential because it has the support of a strong number of Lebanese people. I mean, it's not imposed on the Lebanese people. It's a movement that struggled and then it's won its place in Lebanese society, in Lebanese population, through its role in politics, through its role in the struggle against the Israeli aggression, and of course eventually in the polls. So it's a perfectly legitimate organization that is part of the fabric of Lebanon and has every right to sit and enjoy life in Lebanon as any other organization and any other movement that represents the fringe of the population, the Lebanese population.
Well, Dasha, your take on that, because it just seems so unbelievably hypocritical of a Saudi politician talking about that the problems in general in Lebanon is because of Hezbollah, when the Saudis have been so involved in complicating the situation, as we can see with this current situation, and trying to put more pressure on the Lebanese people. Your take about all of this?
One could really, ask the question hypothetically whether Lebanon would even exist today if it wasn't for the resistance efforts of Hezbollah. It has not only freed Lebanon from the Zionist occupation, but has also continues to defend Lebanon against the Zionist infiltrations, as well as the terrorist groups that were trying to infiltrate through Syria for many years. So Hezbollah does guarantee the sovereignty of Lebanon. And this is, again, something that we've seen today. There are three parties in the parliament that have condemned the attacks against the Minister of Information, and one of those three parties was Hezbollah, whereas the majority of the other parties was either asking him to apologize or condemning him. So in many ways, Hezbollah guarantees the sovereignty and the independence of Lebanon, and also guarantees the sovereignty and independence of those in Lebanon who oppose Hezbollah. But this is, of course, something that might be too complex to understand if we are, coming from a Saudi perspective that is based on coercion and violence. And again, what I also find very, very dangerous at this point is the amount of conspiracy theories that there are. Particularly in Lebanon, there are, I think we see from, there are some opponents of Hezbollah rather than critics. There's less legitimate criticism, I would say, that we hear, but more outright opposition because of ideological or sectarian reasons. And then oftentimes there's this sort of narrative conspiracy theory, I would say, of an alleged Iranian occupation. This is, of course, a minority that is peddling this discourse, but it happens, it gets brought up every once in a while whenever there is such a tension as was taking place since yesterday. And it is, of course, completely ridiculous and ahistorical, and also whitewashes the violent role that Saudi Arabia has had, because Saudi Arabia is effectively more or less aligned with the Zionist regime that is actively trying to undermine Lebanon's sovereignty. It was just one of the many problems here.
Hafsa, where do you see all of this going? Do you think that divide is going to continue and even widen now between Saudi Arabia and Lebanon, or your analysis of this overall situation at this point?
Difficult to say, because obviously Lebanon is at a very, very weak point, and therefore, I mean, they've obviously tried to rectify the situation and sort of appease the Saudis in whatever way they can. Saudi Arabia, being the bully boy that it is, will obviously kick somebody, especially when they're down. Obviously, they never stand up to the US. They would never stand up to any Western country whatsoever, but they can easily stand up to Lebanon, which is a small country, which is a resourceless country, and which is at the moment in a very, very weak spot. So I'm assuming that they're going to perhaps exert more pressure, and I think the Lebanese are going to try and find some sort of compromise at some point. Hopefully they won't compromise too much, because, of course, if they do that further, then they can only make the situation worse because of the next crisis. Who knows what the Saudis are going to expect?
Danja, 30 seconds. Let me get Danja in here. 30 seconds. Same question.
Yeah,
completely agree. I think Saudi Arabia is weakened and is just trying to bully Lebanon. This is not the first time, and I think, you know, effectively Lebanon will prevail. I mean, despite this crisis and everything, there is going to be a way to move forward. Lebanon is part of the axis of resistance and has produced the the strongest non-state actor, among the strongest militaries, which is Hezbollah in the region, and it just shows the resilience of the resistance, which continues.
And on that note, thank you both for being with me on this Spotlight. Journalist and political analyst Hafsa Karat Mustafa out of London, researcher out of Beirut, Danijel Yonchek. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. I'm your host, Musa Al-Bahadli, and joining me is our dear friend, Sayyid Muhsin Naqawi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, welcome and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Our question today is about the theological beliefs of Islam and also the rulings of Islam. Mm-hmm. And in a world where the Western world especially is so focused on these rights and laws, it is refreshing to see that Islam already had such rulings in place. And our question regards one such ruling. Why is it that in Islam, custody of children is given to the father, when almost all of the problems and troubles that are associated with the upbringing of children, such as birthing, breastfeeding, raising, and so on and so forth, are the responsibility of the mother? This is the opposite of what the entire developing world is actually doing, where they give the custody to the woman. So what then is the reasoning behind this in Islam, dear Sayyid?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created us He just not created us for just in vain. There is a purpose behind it. Right. And there are some responsibilities and tasks that we have in our life which we need to fulfill in order to become the true slaves of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. In the Quran, I was looking at the verse number 233 of Surah Al-Baqarah, chapter Baqarah, this is second chapter, verse number 233. In that, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَالْوَالِدَاتُ يُرْضِعْنَ أَوْلَادَهُنَّ حَوْلَيْنِ كَامِلَيْنِ, that the mothers should breastfeed their children for 2 years, complete 2 years.
Right. Okay.
This is the first part, and there are some other parts of it, other than that. And after that, it says, وَعَلَى الْمَوْلُودِ, and upon the one who had the child, lehu, for him. Now here, Allah is talking about the father now. First, he talked about the mother, that mother should breastfeed for two years, the complete 2 years. And after that, wa'alal mawludi lehu, and for the one who has the child, like the father, rizquhunna wa kisfatuhunna bil ma'roof.
Right.
Allah has put the responsibility of sustenance, bringing food, clothes, everything on the father.
He bears the responsibility of
he
not
has
just
the responsibility,
woman,
yes,
but also the child.
For the child and the woman as well.
Right.
Even if I say, in the divorce, generally, the husband and wife, they are separate in the divorce. Even in the divorce, if the child is under the custody of the mother, obviously there are the rulings. I will explain about the rulings as well.
Of course.
The father has the responsibility of providing the food and clothes to the son and his mother as well. because she's feeding the child. So even at that time, the both, like, he has to bring some kind of sustenance to help out the mother, like, in order to raise this child.
Because so she's taking care of his child.
Yes, his child. Now, in the jurisprudence, we see that the custody of child, when we talk about the child, we need to separate the boy and girl.
Right.
We need to separate it.
So there's a for difference.
The, yes, there's a difference. For the boy, he can, after the birth, he can stay, he's in the custody of his mother for 2 years.
Right.
And after that, he moves to the custody of father. For the girl, she will remain in the custody of mother for 7 years, and after that, she will go towards the father. That's the first thing.
It's a big difference then.
Yes, big difference. Now, on the other hand, if we look at the age of bulugh, becoming adult in the Islamic terms, we say baligh.
We do not really use the term puberty in this manner.
No. That's why I'm using the Arabic terminology.
Right.
Baligh. Right. You know, that's something else.
Becoming of age in an Islamic manner.
In an Islamic manner, becoming adult, like legally, they can decide for themselves. So that's why I use the word adult, and then I'm using the word baligh, bulugh.
Right.
When they become baligh or they are bulugh, this is an Arabic term, baligh. It's not the English term, it's an Arabic. For the boy, it is said he becomes baligh at the age of 15.
Right.
For the girl, it is at age of 9. Now, when you look at this age, that the boy was with the mother, under the custody of mother for 2 years, and until the age of 15, he's under the custody of father.
Right.
And when once he becomes baligh, obviously he's baligh. Now he can decide for himself if he wants. If he is aqil, he is obviously he has all those conditions.
Right.
For the girl, she remains with her mother for 7 years, and after that, for 2 years, she's with the father, because at the age of 9, she becomes baligh.
Right.
So on the other hand, we can see like there is a less amount for the father as well. It's both ways. Like the girl is for 2 years with the father, and 7 years with the mother. On the other hand, boy, yes, he is 2 years with the mother, the first 2 years, and then the rest of 13 years with
and
the
father. That's assuming they don't hit so belugh or puberty, we say in parentheses, before
now,
that.
The problem is when we look at these issues, like the rulings in the jurisprudence in Islam, we should not look at the sub-rule. We should look at something as a whole, from all aspects. And then you can decide whether it is, according to the justice or not, whether the custody, more custody is with the father or the mother. Okay? So we cannot just decide by looking at one part.
Of course.
First thing is that it is a clear ruling that the boy, for first 2 years, and after that, the custody goes to the father. First 2 years is with the mother, and then it goes to the father. For the girl, first 7 years, the custody is with the mother, and the rest is with the father. Until they become baligh. On the other hand, we see that the food, the clothes, all these things are the responsibilities of father. And this is a clear statement of the Quran that وَعَلَى الْمَوْلُودِ لَهُ رِزْقُهُنَّ وَكِسْفَتُهُنَّ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ.
Right.
You know, it is upon the father to bring, not upon the mother. It's not upon the mother. So then everything is the responsibility of father from, you know, the very first day till end. Even the mother can take money for the breastfeed.
Right. You know, she cannot be forced to breastfeed.
Yeah, she cannot be forced, it is said.
Even though it is her own child.
Yes, it is the ruling for her own child. She cannot, you know, forcibly be. So she can claim for some, you know, money or
compensation
for that.
It's basically and a he job has to with pay. Salary.
Yes, he has to pay. So she can have a good salary at that time.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir. Inshallah, inshallah,
see that the whole responsibility is with the father.
In reality.
Now, why it is said that the boy should remain with the mother for 2 years and the girl for the 7 years?
Some might pose a question here.
Yes, it's because the first 2 years is important for every child.
Right.
Because in the Quran, Allah has said, like, the mother should breastfeed the child for 2 years.
There's a natural physical need.
It's natural. It's scientifically, the doctor says, do not give this powder, the milk. Use the mother should breastfeed the...
Breast milk is healthier.
And he or she, like the boy or girl, should be breastfeed for 2 years. So first 2 years. After that, we can see that, obviously, boys should follow the footsteps of father. Because he has to go out naturally, he has to be trained as a man so that he can serve the society, the responsibilities that he has. That's why after 2 years, he straightforward goes to the custody of the father. Whereas girl remains for 7 years with the mother. And last 2 years, before becoming baligh, goes to the father. Now in those 7 years, the first 7 years, she's getting trained by the mother.
Right.
And those last 2 years is for him so that she is also attached to the father. She does not forget her father.
Of course, when
and
you say
after
training,
that she becomes, yes.
We mean being raised.
Yeah, being raised. When we talk about the training, it's been being raised,
being accustomed to the manners, etiquette, how should a woman be, how should a male be for that manner.
All these things are obviously including. We include in these, when we talk about the training and the...
Right.
Being raised up, brought up. So if they are, when we talk about they're brought up, being trained, raised up, all these things includes all those factors. And it is obviously, logical, it is right that the boys generally, the fathers are the role models for the boys.
Right.
And for girls, it's their mother generally, they're the role models, naturally it is. So that's what Islam talks about. So therefore, when we talk about the Islamic rulings, rather than saying like why Islam has said that the father should have the custody of the children, it's not like that. There are specific rulings. For boys, it's different. For girls, it's different.
Right.
As a whole, the whole responsibility is on the shoulders of father.
Right.
You know, if the kids remains under the custody of mother, he's paying for the child and the mother. Whereas when the child becomes like comes in the custody of the father, then he's just looking after the kid. He is not paying anything extra to the one who's been divorced or separated. I don't know the different ways.
Right.
So logically, when we see logically and intellectually, when we see the whole picture, then we do understand why is this happening, and it is according to the justice.
Right. So they say it, and when we say that the custody goes from the mother to the father for perhaps a boy after he has spent 2 years with the mother, must the father take him to live with him, for example, or can he choose to let the child stay with his mother?
It's upon the two parties, basically. It's upon the father, because after 2 years, it's the responsibility of father. But if father... says or agrees that the child can remain with his mother, that's fine.
So
there's no compulsion.
Right.
The compulsion is yes. There is a ruling. The ruling has been set that after 2 years, the custody is with the father.
Right.
But if the father allows child to remain with the mother, and if they agree, both parties, like the mother and father, for specific years, for example, even if they agree, both of them agree, like the child will remain under the custody, the boy remains under the custody of mother for 7 years, for example, 8 years. And after that, father will take the custody or responsibility after onwards. That is fine. The doors are open.
Okay.
It's a mutual understanding.
They're flexible.
There is a specific rule. There's a basic rule which we need to follow. At least we need to follow this. After that, Islam has left the doors open for the mother and father.
Right.
That if they think this is good for their child, they can decide the same thing.
And just one small question adding on to this. Can the mother then also claim compensation if the child stays with her? Or
no, if it is an agreement between them, after the 2 years, there is no responsibility on the father for the boy.
Okay.
And after 7 years for the girl, there is no responsibility for the mother. Right. Yes, for the child there is, obviously, until they become valid.
Right. Dear Said, I thank you for your time and
welcome.
Taking time out of the day to answer these questions. I also thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. Yet again, this had been your host, Musa Al-Bahadli, and you have been listening to the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Thank you for tuning in.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
About 4,000 high school students took to the streets of the Italian capital to stage a rally against the upcoming G20 summit of world leaders. Pupils from secondary schools called on the summit's participants to stop the injustices that, quote, have led the planet to the climate crisis and invest significantly in public education as a way to give them a future. The G20 summit will reportedly focus on climate change, health, and the global economic recovery.
We already know for sure that the world leaders will not opt to invest in public health, social welfare, or in fixing the climate crisis. Quite the contrary, their resolutions will be taken in support of banks and large multinationals.
We are here because our school system is on its knees. Public education must be a priority. World leaders must understand it.
Also on Friday, charities Oxfam, Amnesty International and Emergency held a flash mob in Rome's city center demanding world leaders to end global inequality of access to vaccines and coronavirus treatments. According to charity's representatives, billions of people around the world are denied access to COVID vaccine because big pharmas are actively blocking other manufacturers from producing much-needed doses and continue to prioritize selling vaccines to rich countries.
The situation is very serious because in low-income countries at the moment, less than 2% of the population have been fully vaccinated, while in high-income countries, the average is more than 60%.
A large security operation will be enforced with a 10 square kilometer maximum security area in the Eur Quarter, the district surrounding the Congress Center where the G20 summit is taking place. The authorities are wary of the danger that anti-vax extremists and black blocs may pose if they infiltrate the protests. Airspace is closed over Rome and border controls have been enhanced in the attempt to keep away violent protesters.
The G20 summit kicks off on Saturday. Up to 6,000 police officers along with 500 soldiers will be deployed in the Italian capital as authorities fear violent demonstrations during the meeting. Max Civili, Rome.
The European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen greeted Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki at the beginning of a five-hour debate in the European Parliament. The niceties didn't last long.
don't try to divert. That's the debate right now here about the rule of law and the primacy of European law. Don't try to run away and to escape that debate.
Morawiecki insists Poland's constitution has primacy over EU law, and this is infuriating the bloc's establishment. Amongst other things, EU authorities are worried the Polish government is trampling on fundamental rights, judicial independence and freedom of the press. Morawiecki insists hypocrisy is at play when rule of law is debated.
Some member states maintain tax havens. It means that in the EU, the richest member states are making even more money. How is this part of our EU values?
Criticism towards Morawiecki kept on coming, however.
For years, you have been infecting the minds of Polish people with lies and manipulation about European rules and regulations.
The Polish Prime Minister raised a myriad of issues, ranging from the EU's energy crisis to the refugee situation, but the focus repeatedly came back to him. Analysts say the EU is in no position to preach about rule of law in the light of its treatment of minority groups in the bloc, such as refugees. The problem has become worse due to recent developments in Afghanistan.
What this is doing is this is leading to a rise in xenophobia. These refugees, these people who, as I said, are at the lowest possible ebb, are now being subject to abuse and to hate crimes.
Inside the chamber, Morawiecki was criticised over his country's treatment of refugees, but he certainly was not without his supporters. Lawmakers want the European Commission to withhold billions of euro in funding to Poland, but that could be a lengthy process. When the Commission initiates proceedings against a member state, it normally takes many years before there is a conclusion to the case. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The night in March 2021 that 33-year-old Sarah Everard was arrested, raped and murdered by police officer Wayne Curzons. He has been handed a life sentence, but since the murder, public trust in the force has plummeted. In 4 years, 2,000 officers have been accused of sexual misconduct, including rape. Nearly two-thirds of them have faced no further action. And a quarter of misconduct hearings are closed to the public. Britain's most senior police officer has promised a thorough investigation into the Met's culture, and the Independent Force for Police Conduct says it is dealing with a slew of new referrals since it changed the criteria for abuse of power for sexual purposes.
But is it about referral criteria or something more ingrained and sinister? Curzons was nicknamed the rapist by his colleagues. So why wasn't he weeded out earlier by the Met?
Climate change is sort of steroids for the weather. That's what experts say. From the northernmost to the southernmost points of the Earth, nowhere and no one is immune to this crisis. In India, people have been devastated by frequent heat waves.
We are affected a lot by this unbearable heat, and us poor are hit the hardest.
And so are Canadians.
It's just unbearable. It's impossible to be out.
This year, July was declared the world's hottest month ever recorded. A recent study shows if the world's emission of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases continues at the same level, in 30 years' time, there will be a climate change apocalypse. That means outdoor life in parts of the Middle East and North Africa would be impossible, regions that are already facing long periods of extreme heat.
We are very tired and cannot stand in the sun. Our situation is very bad. We are exhausted.
Researchers are now warning that even animals and plants are in danger. In a bid to survive, some countries are already looking for new ways to adapt to these intense situations. In Bangladesh, one of the countries worst affected by the extreme weather in recent decades, farmers are developing floating seed beds and salt-resistant rice to avoid unpredictable conditions.
This is the digital age. We saw on YouTube how greenhouse farming works. We tried it on a smaller scale, though. I am doing greenhouse farming this year on 8,000 square feet of land.
Estimates show that $5 trillion a year are needed by 2030 to find measures to fight global warming. But despite signs of progress in a few sectors, the majority of the tasks required for curbing the rising temperatures still seem to be far-fetched. And many are now saying that the upcoming United Nations conference, COP26, is the last major chance to galvanize a collective effort to fight climate change.
Unless there are immediate, rapid, and large-scale reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, we will be unable to limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius, and the consequences will be catastrophic. COP26 this November must mark that turning point. By then, we need all countries to commit to achieve net zero emissions by the middle of this century and to present clear, credible, long-term strategies to get there.
All these are reminders that the fatal consequences of this human-induced crisis are threatening our planet now more than ever before.
Afghanistan has welcomed the recent remarks by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, who called for greater unity between Sunnis and Shias. This according to a tweet by a spokesman of the political office of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, Muhammad Naeem Wardak. He further said the Taliban are aware of the nation's enemies' scheme and work for tightening brotherhood among Afghan people.
The U.S. has always been trying to deepen the schism between Muslim sects both after the invasion and after the withdrawal. They don't stop their conspiracy, but the Islamic Emirate is aware of it and will never let the enemies of Islam reach their goals. However, they target Shias, but in fact they are against all of us.
Afghan people have also welcomed Iran's leaders' remarks. In a conference titled Islamic Unity Week and the Responsibility of People in the Afghan capital on Tuesday, the participants said Islamic unity should be part of culture in Muslim world.
Prominent Islamic scholar and the late founder of Iran's Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khomeini, in a very critical point of time came and named this week as Islamic Unity Week, so that all Muslims keep their unity and brotherhood. We all have the same God, Prophet, and Qibla. Then let's benefit from these mutual values for our unity and make it a culture.
Addressing the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference in the Iranian capital, Iran's leader touched on the U.S. campaign to stoke sedition among Islamic countries with the help of its proxies. He said the recent unfortunate and distressing explosions at mosques targeting Muslim worshippers in Afghanistan are among such incidents that were carried out by Daesh. Earlier this month, Daesh terrorist group conducted two deadly attacks against Shia community in Afghanistan. Following the attacks, Muslim leaders noted that such incidents are meant to divide Muslims in the war-torn country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
France's latest unemployment data showed a small improvement, but unemployment remains nearly 8%, at least officially. 5.9 million people remain unemployed, which is just a fraction less than the all-time high of 6.3 million in 2017. Back in September 2008, the total jobless numbered just 4.5 million. That means French unemployment has risen over 30% since the start of the Great Recession. With re-election just 6 months away, many say that Macron is running out of time to devote resources to the jobless or to devise a new system of accounting. Macron campaigned on a promise to bring unemployment under 7%.
His effort, or his promise to increase employment by changing labor laws that would make France more attractive to foreign investors just hasn't worked. This idea of bringing in migrants for cheap labor to keep wages down is a real issue. So it's a big problem for Macron.
Under Macron's predecessor, François Hollande, the jobless rate increased 44 out of 46 months at one point. To change that, Hollande controversially started excluding part-time underemployed workers from the official count. Macron went one better and declared that just looking for work once in the past month no longer makes someone unemployed. Macron also began revealing jobless data only once every 3 months to avoid media discussion of the unpopular issue.
We have to really distinguish between what the official unemployment rate is and what the unofficial unemployment rate is. And if we take what the potential workforce is, it's much, much higher. And it's really amazing because the service sectors, like restaurants and bars and stores and stuff, can't find people to fill positions. And the reason is they don't pay enough.
For years, many French economists have said that the official unemployment rate is undercounted by a third, which would put the real unemployment rate at well over 20%. The Macron era had been one of constant economic unrest, but the coronavirus pause seems to have ended, with protests recently increasing in number and intensity. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
President of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, has sent a stern message to the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, slamming the world body's inaction regarding Saudi Arabia's bloody war on Yemen.
Unfortunately, Saudi money has weakened the role of the United Nations in Yemen and has changed the world body's political position. The United Nations' primary concern should be the humanitarian situation in Yemen, but it has failed to consider that.
In the message sent to Antonio Guterres on United Nations Day, Mashat called on the UN to stop manipulating the facts in Yemen for political ends. He said the world body has effectively covered up for Saudis during 7 years of war under blockade. He added that the UN failure to renew the mandate of the Human Rights Council's group of eminent experts is yet another proof of how Saudis are bribing their way through the world body.
It was not so much a message of congratulation as it was a message of blame for the UN's negative role regarding what the Yemeni people have been subjected to over the past 7 years. It's a clear message that the UN must play its role and that the international community has failed morally in Yemen. We are ready to support the continued work of the United Nations and its humanitarian organizations and facilitate their operations inside Yemen, but on the condition that the United Nations protects the Yemeni people and stops Saudi violations.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war on Yemen on March 2015. The war has killed tens of thousands of people, including women and the children, and has pushed the country to the brink of famine.
Yemenis say the United Nations continues to apply double standards when dealing with the ongoing Saudi crimes against millions of Yemenis. They believe that the Yemeni army's operations are legitimate as it is defending the sovereignty of Yemen, which is the only way forward to put an end to the humanitarian crisis in the country. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
They're small in number, but they have big voices resonating along the streets of Oldham, Manchester, calling for Israeli arms company Elbit Systems to be shut down.
This is the Elbit site in Manchester, and the event here organized by several pro-Palestinian groups who accuse Elbit of providing Israel with predatory drones and other military hardware, accusing it of complicity in Israeli war crimes and in abetting Israel in terrorizing the people of Gaza.
Elbit Systems UK, a subsidiary of the Israel-based company of the same name, employs over 500 people and has 10 sites in the UK, including 4 factories.
Israel is an apartheid state. It's a racist state which is preventing Palestinians from living their ordinary everyday lives. And indeed worse, it's starving them, it's bombing them, it's killing them, it's depriving them of their lands and homes. And it has been since 1948. This factory here, Elbit, is the largest private Israeli arms factory. There's 10 outlets in the UK, and they are all making drones and weapons which go to kill Palestinians.
Apart from supplying Israel with weaponry, Elbit is also a major supplier of sophisticated technology to the British military.
That Britain and Israel have a clear, incestuous, revolving door type of relationship between each of their military establishments and their arms companies. We are fighting back against that here.
In August, pro-Palestine activists took their fight to another level. Direct action against the same site in Oldham causing disruption to the firm's operations. For their actions, they often face intimidation, arrest, and possible prison time. But they say they're unfazed. Events such as the one today have led to increased public awareness about Elbit and its operations and growing calls for its closure. That, the activists say, is one important step towards a free Palestine.
Fear is growing in Indian-controlled Kashmir following a series of shooting incidents across the region that killed around a dozen civilians, including four non-local workers. The fear doubled among the non-local residents after police said non-locals should reach army camps and police stations. Dhananjit Kumar has been working in Kashmir for the last 12 years. Each year he stays here for 6 months and returns home with his hard-earned money. But this year he's moving ahead of time.
My family back home is worried. They insisted upon my return. I have worked for so many years here, but I have never seen such chaos. The situation here has never been right, but we were never involved. This time, it's different.
Dhananjit Kumar and many like him are on the move, while many others have sought police protection till they manage a way out. Following the deadly October violence in Kashmir that resulted in more than 33 killings, which included 9 Indian Army personnel, 11 civilians, and 13 pro-freedom fighters in different incidents, the administration issued an alert across the war-weary Indian-administered Kashmir. Intelligence reports warn of attacks on power projects, emergency landing strips, and other government infrastructure. New Delhi has installed additional security forces across Kashmir after intelligence reports warned of more attacks.
We are doing our best to neutralize the terrorists who are behind the civilian killings. We have killed around 11 terrorists in October till now, and we'll do our best to ensure the safety and security of our people. It's not a security lapse. The targets were soft, and now we beefed up and more vigilant.
After India stripped Kashmir's autonomous status in August 2019, people of the region were promised development, prosperity, and greater opportunities. However, media reports suggest the situation in the region has slipped from bad to worse due to the absence of local political activities and implementation of rules and laws without taking people of Kashmir on board. Kashmir is a dispute between India and Pakistan since the partition of Indian subcontinent in 1947. The two have fought wars over the territory and claimed the region in full, but rule it in parts. The fresh spate of violence in Indian-administered Kashmir is seen by many as a politically motivated action. People of Kashmir urge the world community to help resolve this geopolitical dispute between India and Pakistan before they engage in war and devastate the leftover lives. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen greeted Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki at the beginning of a five-hour debate in the European Parliament. The niceties didn't last long.
Don't try to divert. That's the debate right now here about the rule of law and the primacy of European law. Don't try to run away and to escape that debate.
Morawiecki insists Poland's constitution has primacy over EU law, and this is infuriating the bloc's establishment. Amongst other things, EU authorities are worried the Polish government is trampling on fundamental rights, judicial independence, and freedom of the press. Morawiecki insists hypocrisy is at play when rule of law is debated.
Some member states maintain tax havens. It means that in the EU, the richest member states are making even more money. How is this part of our EU values?
Criticism towards Morawiecki kept on coming, however.
For years, you have been infecting the minds of Polish people with lies and manipulation about European rules and regulations.
The Polish Prime Minister raised a myriad of issues, ranging from the EU's energy crisis to the refugee situation, but the focus repeatedly came back to him. Analysts say the EU is in no position to preach about rule of law in the light of its treatment of minority groups in the bloc, such as refugees. The problem has become worse due to recent developments in Afghanistan.
What this is doing is this is leading to a rise in xenophobia. These refugees, these people who, as I said, are at the lowest possible ebb, are now being subject to abuse and to hate crimes.
Inside the chamber, Morawiecki was criticized over his country's treatment of refugees, but he certainly was not without his supporters. Lawmakers want the European Commission to withhold billions of euro in funding to Poland, but that could be a lengthy process. When the Commission initiates proceedings against a member state, it normally takes many years before there is a conclusion to the case. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In the U.S., the Food and Drug Administration on Friday, 29th of October, granted emergency use authorization for a lower dose of the Pfizer coronavirus vaccine for children aged 5 to 11, marking a major milestone towards making a population of around 28 million kids eligible to be vaccinated in the United States. The article you're about to hear has been written by Kaya Hubbard, a general news reporter at U.S. News and World Report. The piece is titled, FDA Authorizes Pfizer COVID-19 Vaccine for Kids 5 to 11. In the United States, the Food and Drug Administration on Friday, 29th of October, granted emergency use authorization for a lower dose of the Pfizer coronavirus vaccine for children aged 5 to 11 years old, marking a major milestone towards making a population of around 28 million kids eligible to be vaccinated. This is a day so many parents eager to protect their young children from this virus have been waiting for. Pfizer's Chief Executive Officer Albert Bourla said in a statement, over 6 million children in the United States have been diagnosed with COVID-19 since the start of this pandemic, and a high number of young people continue to be infected every week. With this FDA authorization, we have achieved another key marker in our ongoing effort to help protect families and communities and to get this disease under control. The agency's Vaccine Advisory Committee earlier this week announced overwhelming support for use of the vaccine shot, which Pfizer estimates to be over 90% effective in the age group. The decision now heads to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC's Vaccine Committee, which will take up the issue early next week, making the shots available to kids as early as midweek. The Biden administration has already published its plan to distribute the vaccine shots should they gain authorization, which includes sending the shots to more than 25,000 pediatric offices and other primary care sites, over 100 children's hospital systems, and tens of thousands of pharmacies. Hundreds of schools and community-based clinics will also get them. But making the vaccine shots available does not mean the majority of parents will be on board. According to a survey data released this week by the Kaiser Family Foundation, 3 in 10 American parents say they will definitely not get their 5 to 11-year-old kids vaccinated against the coronavirus, with the majority citing potential unknown long-term effects and serious side effects of the vaccine as the main reason for their concern. Still, getting a large share of the child population vaccinated would have a big impact on the pandemic's outlook, according to the country's leading infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci. Dr. Fauci said at a recent press conference, "If we can get the overwhelming majority of those 28 million children vaccinated, I think that will play a major role in diminishing the spread of infection in the community." Announcing its authorization of a lower dose shot made by Pfizer and BioNTech for the 5 to 11-year-old age group, the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, said clinical trial data showed the shot was safe and prompted strong immune responses in children. The most common side effects were fatigue, fever, and headache. Infectious disease experts say that with approaching holiday travel and family gatherings, widespread vaccination of younger children could be a game changer. It could help keep classes in person, reduce the likelihood of quarantines, and lessen the risk of transmission to older, more vulnerable adults, as well as protect the children from what has become the eighth biggest killer in their age group, according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. To date, nearly 2 million American children aged between 5 and 11 have been infected with the coronavirus, and 8,300 have been hospitalized. A third of those hospitalized were admitted to intensive care units, and at least 170 children have died. But a report this month from researchers at Northeastern University, Harvard University, Rutgers University, and Northwestern University found that parental concerns around the COVID vaccination had increased significantly from June through to September. Chief among them, researchers said, were the newness of the vaccine, whether it has been sufficiently tested, its efficacy, its side effects, and long-term health consequences. According to a survey released on Thursday, 28th of October, by the Kaiser Family Foundation, scarcely one in three parents will permit their children in this newly eligible age group to be vaccinated immediately. Two-thirds of parents were either reluctant or adamantly opposed to giving vaccine shots to their children. An Axios Ipsos poll found that 42% of parents said they were unlikely to have their children vaccinated.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Today we're going to be answering and examining a question which is often mentioned and brought up, especially by non-Muslims, and that is this: is Islam a violent religion or not? This question is almost too simple, and obviously it's the simplicity of the question which makes answering it very difficult. But if we want to answer this question and analyze it and see whether Islam per se, not the actions of Muslims, are necessarily violent or not, it's important for us to take a look at the seerah and the conduct of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. One of the features, one of the salient features of our Prophet, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, was his incredible ability to pardon and forgive even his most staunchest enemies. In fact, Allah Ta'ala describes the Prophet in the Holy Quran as being a mercy to all creation. And this is clearly a testament to his most merciful and forgiving nature. The Prophet, in many instances, he had the ability to punish and be violent towards certain people because of their past offenses, but the Prophet forgave them and mercifully overlooked their faults. One of the first people that we can mention in this regard was a person named Thumama ibn Uthal. He was one of the Arab leaders, and he had once killed a group of the Prophet's companions. Eventually, this person was captured by the Muslims, and they brought him to the mosque in Medina, and they tied him to a pillar there. However, during his imprisonment, the Prophet ensured that he was treated well. He was given food and drink, and even the Prophet even instructed him to be given milk from his own camel. The Prophet would ask about his condition in the time when he was in prison, and this person would ask for forgiveness from the Prophet. After the third day of his imprisonment, the Prophet instructed his companions to release this person unconditionally. This person couldn't believe that he was pardoned, he went out of the mosque and returned a little while afterwards, and he pronounced his shahadatain, and that he was Muslim. He was inspired by this kindness of the Holy Prophet, and he said that this was one of the reasons why he turned to Islam. There's many stories in the life of the Holy Prophet regarding this. The prime example that history tells us is when the Prophet came, vanquished Mecca, and he forgave all of those people who had who up till that time were showing enmity to him. And even though this is the height of his power and he had the ability to take revenge from those people. And the Prophet's famous that the Prophet said, "Idhab fa antumut talaqa," and "Al yom yomul marhama." This is a very famous saying of the Holy Prophet. So today is the day of mercy, and that today you are free, and there will be no respital and revenge against you. And thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at Islam and violence and the conduct of the Holy Prophet and his kindness as an inspiration for nonviolence for all Muslims. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.